The dreadful pain and suffering of eating disorders is in the news again today. Two local families have told Good Morning Ulster of their despair after their children died. Lawrence Nugent and Danielle O'Neill were only 24 when complications from bulimia and anorexia led to their deaths. Lawrence's mother, Pamela, told the BBC's Tara Mills about the terrible impact his illness had on their family.
We were in despair. We didn't know who to turn to for help because Lawrence wouldn't allow us. It was his secret. He was totally ashamed of himself and he hated himself. Told us he hated the very look of himself. And as a family, we lived in turmoil every day. We didn't know whether Lawrence was going to be alive when we came home. I used to ring him from work at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to make sure he was alive. You were afraid for him, very, very afraid for him. He took an overdose. He tried to hang himself. He tried to cut himself. That's how far gone he was in despair.
Well, you're about to hear a very sad, tragic story now. I've been speaking to Steve Seddon. His daughter, Charlotte, suffered from anorexia throughout her teens. After a four-year battle, she checked into the Priory for 4 months in the hope of finally beating the disease. But 12 days later, Charlotte suffered a cardiac arrest and died. She was just 17. Her family has since found the diary that she kept while she was receiving treatment for anorexia. And Steve wants to share some of this with you. He told me what Charlotte was like as a little girl.
You know, she was a twin. And, you know, the girls were always treated the same. Well, we like to think we treated them the same. She was a very, very fun girl, always happy. Her twin sister, Abigail, as kids, we always had a little thing with them where it was a bit of a family thing where we used to call Abigail Crabby Abby and Charlotte Cheerful Charlie because she was always smiling.
And had she any issues with her self-confidence, anything like that in the early years?
Not as a youngster, no. At a very young age, I think we probably noticed things maybe around her early teens.
Things like what?
Well, it starts really, well, it certainly started with us. She sort of started getting to a point with food and meals and things where she decided that she wanted to become a vegetarian, that type of thing. And we sort of went, that's probably a phase that she's going through and we sort of understand, I guess, she might be getting a little bit of peer pressure and that sort of thing. And then that just sort of one thing led to another, really, in her... early teens, 13, 14, we noticed that she was starting to eat less and that sort of thing and missing meals and these sort of things, really.
And that would be presumably quite common with some parents listening to this, mum and dad saying, look, you've got to eat properly, don't be eating nonsense, look after your diet, and you probably thought it was part of a teenage phase.
Absolutely, yeah, no more than that, really.
What would she say?
The usual things were, I don't want that, I don't really fancy that, I'm not really hungry, all that sort of thing, really, you know.
At what point did you think to yourself, there's something really wrong here?
Well, my wife and I had sort of been talking, really, and she'd sort of said, you know, you hear about these sort of things in the media and what do you think? And I said, well, yeah. I said, she does look physically like she is starting to lose weight and that sort of thing. So we sort of said we need to start getting some help for her if we can, which is one of the things that we found extremely difficult. one of the difficult things in the early stages was the fact that. We went to the GP with her, and the GP had sort of said, thanks for bringing her down, this sort of thing. And then asked my wife to leave the room. She sort of spoke to her on her own, and I mean, that was at the age of 14, which we still sort of look back today and believe that really that's wrong. They're still a child. We're still responsible for them. And she sort of had private chats and discussions with her.
So you think you should have been there?
Absolutely. My wife took her there because of the concern that we had. But I can sort of read you a little bit here from some of the things that she wrote about that day. Sort of said that...
you've got... And just to explain to people, what you've got is Charlotte's diary.
No. Yeah, we just took a few little notes from that, really. Some of the difficult times that she were having from sort of way back when, some of the early stages. I mean, this is from sort of 2008, where she was sort of age 14 at that time. And she talks about today being a total whirlwind. I don't know what I'm doing here. I don't know where I am or where I'm going or how I'm going to get there. I'm sick to the back teeth of all this uncertainty. I just wish someone had made that decision for me. I went to the doctors and Mum started straight away saying she doesn't know whether I'm making myself sick on purpose. The doctor asked Mum to leave the room. And then the doctor asked me how I felt about the way I looked. I told her that Mum had said that I didn't like the way I looked, but what girl does at my age, right? And that's sort of the kind of a discussion that took place at that time.
And so what you're objecting to is that here was your daughter confiding in the doctor with you know, hard evidence that she had low self-esteem, didn't like the way she looked.
Absolutely.
And you as parents couldn't share in that.
That's right. I mean,
What was Charlotte saying to you at that stage? Because at the point you'd taken her to the doctor, obviously you had confronted her and said, look, there is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, she was absolutely in denial at that time. Because I think that's typically the way that some of these things do start. But on saying that, she was in denial with us. But when we sort of read some of the things that that she'd been making a note of later on, unfortunately, after her death, because she was a very private girl, she kept everything absolutely to herself, that she talks about, you know, being down to a particular weight, and now she's got to look to find herself a new weight target, and then when she gets there, she's going to be at a certain weight before she goes on holiday, and she knows she can do that, and then after that, there's no going back from there.
You've brought some of the extracts from her diary in.
Yeah,
I know you've read one, and I know you want to read some more.
Yeah. The reason I've done this is because although it's very private, my concern for other parents to think that if any of their children may be experiencing things like this, quite simply that, yeah, I know they're private, but, you know, be nosy, look at them, talk to them, try and find out what their inner thoughts are. And, you know, this one's from July of the same year where she talks about, I've done it now, I'm 6 stone 10 pounds, so it's time for a new weight target. I'm taking things slow, but I want to be 6 stone 6 before I go on holiday. And apparently that's the weight I can't come back from, but to hell with it. I know I'll be putting on weight on holiday because I can't avoid it. I can't avoid the food like I have been doing. And then there's another note from her closest friend, actually, who's... still a very close friend of ours. We haven't seen her for a long time. She's at university now, studying law. Her friend Becky says, she comments on how proud she's been that she's eaten half a sandwich at lunchtime. She says, I just want you to be happy, the happy bubbly Shaw, the happy, healthy, bubbly. Shaw was a nickname, Shaw for Charlotte. Again, I just want what's best for you. And Charlotte replies, oh, my God, I never knew she felt like that. The point is that as much as I love her, she doesn't understand because she has a perfect body. She always has had. And I know she doesn't like it, but she knows she looks amazing. These are the sort of the things that when people are suffering an eating disorder, they, we've discovered they don't... They've got all the... extremely low self-esteem of themselves. They see something completely different to what you and I see.
And have you any idea, looking at her diaries, having lived with her, what prompted her to think, wrongly think, that she was unattractive? Was there an incident? Was there any type of moment where you can say that's what triggered it?
No, we wish we could, actually, because I think that might give us, as a family, some sort of closure around this thing. But apparently, sometimes it is a trait that particularly follows young people that have a very, very... what can I say? They absolutely want to be perfect in every way, in so much as Charlotte, she was an excellent student.
She was head girl at her school.
Yeah, I mean, I can again, what I've tried to do is come along with a couple of the things that she her accolades from her final years at school. She was head girl, student of the year, best overall female exam results for the year 2009-2010. And within our local town of Burnley, she won an award, the Best of Burnley Awards, for the Young Achiever of the Year 2010.
And with all of that success, she didn't value herself.
Absolutely. That's the problem. Because, unfortunately, people who are like Charlotte was in that respect, they focus on anything at all that can be slightly negative. And she... I don't know whether she felt we, as a family, my wife and I, maybe she felt we didn't praise her enough. I don't know. We like to think we did. We were so proud of her, so proud of her achievements academically.
Did you tell her that?
Yeah, we did, actually, yeah. But, for instance, you know, I think she... all the GCSEs she did, she got all A's and A stars. And I think she got one B, and I can't even remember what the subject was, but all she talked about was the B and how, you know, upset she was at the B.
Now, we touched on it earlier. And by the way, Steve, for something so, so personal, I know this must be incredibly difficult for you sharing it. Thank you for doing so.
Okay.
You touched on it earlier that you had asked for help.
Yeah.
You'd asked the system, you'd asked the NHS for help, had you?
Yeah, we...
Did you get it?
We didn't at the early stages, no. And
That's shocking.
It's absolutely shocking. And, you know, I don't know whether things have changed now much, but we seem to be running around in circles, not really getting anywhere. It was only from intervention from, again, who has come to be a very close friend of ours now, one of her teachers at the time. This lady was keeping in contact with us because she was quite concerned about how Charlotte was. And it was her intervention that actually got some sort of movement around what needed to happen.
When you were asking the system for help, was this through the doctor or who?
Initially through the doctor.
And then who?
And then through the contact came actually from this lady got in contact with the local social services, and two ladies from the social services visited us, and they very quickly got things moving with the local NHS and eating disorder unit, which was literally just down the road from us.
What age what weight was Charlotte by then?
She was in the six and a half stone.
So she's what age then?
14.
14, 6 stone. What height?
She was, let me think now. I think she was just over 5 foot. She was quite short, actually.
But she must have looked incredibly emaciated.
Yes, she was. Yeah, yeah, very much so.
So what help did you need that you didn't get from all of those groups then?
Well, they just didn't seem to be. I mean, even when we got the local, you know, when this thing sort of got set up with the local hospital and the local eating disorder unit, they're in two different towns, which were about 4 miles apart from each other. And sometimes the visit to the hospital was around seeing a guy. I think the guy was a psychiatrist or a therapist of sorts. I'm not absolutely sure what his title was, and also a dietitian there. And then she'd go to the eating disorder unit, which was down the road, where she saw a psychologist and another dietitian. And so sometimes they weren't always. They didn't sort of seem to be talking to each other. And then when she was really, really struggling, the psychologists at the eating disorder unit had said she wanted her to have regular bloods taken. And we were finding it difficult to get that done because we were sort of ringing up the GP. She wanted them doing right away, and the GPs were going, well, we'll do them tomorrow. And she said, no, this is really, really urgent. You know, we need these things doing quite quickly.
My goodness.
To be honest with you, the fact that both my wife and I both work in healthcare, we kind of spoke to a few people and tried to pull a few strings, if that's what you need to do, to get the bloods done. And at one stage, I actually finished up taking her bloods myself to the lab to try and get them done and get the results back quickly. The real concern was the extremely low potassium level.
And did she realise she was in trouble at that stage?
Yeah. I think she did, to be honest.
What was she saying?
It's kind of around about the time when we got her to openly admit that she was suffering from an eating disorder of sorts, typically anorexia nervosa. But she sort of realised that she needed help. What we didn't want to happen, and none of us, including, to be fair, the psychologist that she was seeing at the local eating disorder unit, was for her to be admitted into hospital, into an eating disorder adolescent unit. Everything did was to try and make sure that didn't happen, because, of course, that would be taking her away from home. But we all sort of admitted, Charlotte herself as well, really, that it had got to the stage where she needed to have that care where she could be monitored 24/7.
So she went into the Priory for 4 months?
That's correct, yeah.
What was her time in there like? Did she improve?
Not really, to be honest with you. I mean, again, I can read from some of the sort of the early time when she was in there. She was admitted in there into June, around about June of 2011. And she was in there for about 4 months. And one of the sort of things just say, she puts down and writes, I can't eat, I can't, I can't, I can't. People keep telling me I can solve this myself, but I can't. All people keep telling me, there's only me that can change it, there's only me that can do it, and I've set myself up for failure. I'm nothing but a huge, fat, horrible, ugly failure. She was monitored all the time at the Priory for all the things, in particular the purging, in other words, the vomiting and that sort of thing. Bathroom doors locked, and she had to ask her to go to the toilet and that sort of thing. Obviously, meals were monitored. It's quite a strict regime for obvious reasons, really. The idea being that they could help these young people to change, both get things back and get on the road to recovery from an eating perspective and of course a mental perspective.
And as time went on, she was in the Priory for 4 months. As time went on, do her journals, does her diary indicate in any way any sense of even a slight improvement in her mental state and her attitude towards herself? What was she saying, you know, after 2 or 3 months in there?
Well, this is about a month later. She says, as more and more minutes tick by in this place, I can feel myself getting worse and worse. I can't take it anymore. My thoughts haven't got any easy to deal with. In fact, a million times worse. I saw some pictures of myself at the weekend before I came in here. I want to go back. I want to be thinner. And she writes to us. I mean, obviously, she's alone a lot of the time there in her own room, and We could talk on the phone up to a certain time of day, but she sends us a letter where she says, and this is in September, about September of that year, I think. She says, "Mum, Dad, Abigail and Dan, I love you all. It all just gets too much sometimes, and I'm sorry for everything I do to you. I really am doing my best. I love you all so very much. I love being at home with you and all that you mean to me. You all mean the world to me. One day I'll get better, and I love you all forever and ever. Charlotte." We actually keep that letter in a frame at home above the mantelpiece. Towards the end...
Were you able to visit her much?
Pardon?
Were you able to visit her much?
Yes, we could visit her every day, every evening, obviously.
Wanted to just grab her and pull her out of there at some stage.
We did, a lot of the time, to be honest. And one particular time when she had home leave with us at the weekend, she just said, I can't go back. She got to go to Sunday. She said, I just can't go back. I can't go back there. And we said, well, the problem is if you don't go back there, what happens here? Can we just, we can't look after you. We can't monitor you. What are we going to do? Where are we going to go with this? She actually called her her key worker and spent a little time on the phone with her, and she just said to me, come on, Dad, we need to go back.
That problem went away because the Priory released her.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why did they do that?
Well, you know, we don't know. When my wife and I agreed for me to come in to do this interview with you, Stephen, one thing she'd liked to have done was bring out a letter that Charlotte wrote to us just before she came out. Unfortunately, she just couldn't put her hands on it. But it basically more or less said, I'm not ready to come out of here. Nothing's changed. I'm no different. I'm wrong. I'm going to struggle when I come out. I'm not on the road to recovery. I'm not ready to leave. The Priory said to us a week or two before they discharged her, we had a kind of a discharge meeting with the lead doctor there. And I think it was a gentleman that was from the NHS Trust who was obviously funding her care, where they said she has her disorder is quite chronic, and that's probably a long way. She may never recover totally, but they more or less said they didn't feel that they could do any more for her. Our concern, to be honest with you,
was for her safety.
Absolutely. Well, we were extremely, extremely worried.
And what did they say was the safety plan that was to be wrapped around your daughter?
To be honest with you, there wasn't much in that respect. We even had to make the link with the local GP to get a prescription for a medication and everything when she came out. We were quite. Although we like the idea of her going into the Priory to the point of hopefully they can help her and she can get better, I just think, if I'm being absolutely candid about it, I just think they give up on her, to be honest with you. Because they just couldn't, she was the box that they just couldn't find a peg for.
Well, obviously the Priory, I'm sure, would say that they gave her as much professional care as they could and that it was under medical instruction. That they felt this was the best scenario for her.
The term institutionalised was used, actually.
Yeah. That's what they said to us, to be fair to them.
Yeah, that's what they said to us.
It is often a danger with any patient in any setting. I know this from other work I've done, that if an individual is institutionalised within a hospital setting, that in itself can be dangerous.
Yeah, that's what they said. She's been in there about 4 months now. We do know that children... could be in a lot longer than that, you know. We'd one of the some of the children previously been in 12 months, sometimes longer than that. But I think they'd kind of got to the point where they'd done everything they could. And if I want to just read you the last bit that I've got, actually, where I'm not really sure who wrote this, but someone has actually given this. It was either a therapist or a counsellor. from, I think it must have been the week before she was discharged, around about November of 2011. It's not really dated. And he just says, maybe not now, Charlotte, but one day you can do it. I don't doubt that for a second. You're such a strong person, and when you want to, you'll beat this chronic patient. You'll beat this. Chronic patients normally don't try, but you really have, which is why I believe if you have the faith, you really believe you can do it, please take care of yourself. I don't want your life with so much potential to be another one wasted.
What happened when she came home?
She came home. She was actually quite happy. I hadn't seen her. We'd not seen her so happy for quite some time. She was into a regular dietary plan, which she seemed to be adhering to. Unfortunately, from her coming home and getting back into family life, if that's what we can call it, really, she'd only been back with us for 12 days before, unfortunately, she passed away.
What happened?
She had a very erratic sleeping patterns. She'd had that for quite some time, where she could be up, you know, up all night, really, and then sleeping all day. A lot of that, I think, was due to, obviously, the mental side of things, where she was really struggling with things. But also, perhaps, I think the medication may have had something to do with that as well. One Sunday morning, we were all sort of, we'd been downstairs a while, and her sister came down, and I just said to her, it was getting lots of late in the morning towards lunchtime. I said, "Is your sister okay?" She said, "Oh, I think so." And I said, "Will you just do us a favour, just pop in and make sure she's okay, will you?" And she did, and sort of came downstairs and said, "Yeah, Dad, she's fine. She's doing the usual. She's fast asleep on the floor." And I don't know what it was. It just set alarm bells ringing with me, and I sort of went upstairs. In fact, she said to me, "She's asleep, Dad." And I said, "Are you sure she's asleep?" She said, "Yeah, I think so." And then she went back up, came downstairs. She said, "Dad, I'm not too sure about her. She doesn't seem right." And I went up and had a look at her, and she'd passed away. She'd been gone for several hours, I think, during the night. And it was interesting that she was very big into art. She did an awful lot of artwork. She was looking to study art at university. I was actually due the following week to go to university to Derby University. We were going to go along to an open day there because that's where she was looking to study. And when I found her, she was doing a small piece of art on the floor, and it just said love. That's it.
My goodness. She'd taken a massive heart attack.
Yeah.
Her body basically couldn't take any more.
That's it, I think. The coroner just sort of suggested that that's, in to be honest with you, in a nutshell, was it. The amount of undernutrition she'd experienced, her body had been experiencing for quite some time. Even though, you know, physically, she was looking a bit healthier than she'd looked for quite some time. She had put quite a bit of weight on, not an awful lot, but, you know, a little bit more than she had before she went into the Priory. You know, that it wasn't just about the physical side. It was obviously the other things, you know, the major organs and things.
She was 17 when she died.
That's correct.
And then you're going through that, you know, mind-blowingly painful experience.
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing to try and understand. You can't understand it. The difficult thing, as well as everything else, is you constantly blame yourself. What could we have done?
You tried your best. It's clear. Look, you know, it's clear from what I've heard today. Mm. You've tried your best. You battled to get her medical help.
Yeah, we did actually. That's the thing that I still personally think is quite disjointed between different organisations. It's a very serious, very serious illness, and very, very complex.
And here you are battling now to try to stop this happening from as many other parents.